We're taking stock of a community a decade removed from when the Janesville GM plant went dark. You're with us for an hour-long conversation on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. Thousands of families in Janesville have a connection to the former GM facility. And by the early 70s, it employed more than 7,000 workers. So what are your memories of the plant? How do you think the government should approach companies that threaten to close factories with hundreds or perhaps thousands of jobs at stake? Do you work in manufacturing? Are you worried your plant may be next? We're at 800-642-1234. Tim Cullen grew up in the 50s and 60s when the Janesville GM plant was referred to simply as the plant. He represented Janesville in the state Senate in the 70s and 80s, and again from 2011 to 2015. His new book is called Disassembled, A Native Son on Janesville and General Motors. Tim, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you for having me, Kate. I appreciate it a lot.
Well, before we travel back in time, let's look and compare present day. You worked on trying to save this plant in 2008, and the community suddenly lost 4,500 jobs. How has Janesville recovered since then?
Well, Janesville's making a long, slow recovery. Any expectation that it would be quick or easy, that was entirely dependent on maybe GM coming back or another employer, large employer with 3,000 jobs came. That didn't happen, and those are 100-to-1 shots. So it's a long, slow slog back, but we continue to make progress. But it's not an easy thing to do, but we're doing better. It gets better every year, but it's been now 11 years.
One of the things that you recommend to communities is that they diversify their workforce, diversify their offerings. How does a city do that?
It's very difficult, and it is particularly difficult when your one large employer is doing well. It just seems like it's not a thing you can worry about. It's not an immediate concern. It's an issue of economic development, of advertising your community. It's a variety of ways you could try to do it, but you have to figure out a way to make your community attractive to employers who are considering moving their workload from some other place to hopefully Janesville.
You talked about seeing some warning signs that GM's commitment to Janesville was more fragile, perhaps, than people realized at the time. What were some of those warning signs?
Well, the biggest one was in 1984 when GM announced that they were going to move the small pickup truck production, which had been in Janesville, to their new plant they were building in Fort Wayne, Indiana. They announced that in 1984 and said that the movement of the workload and the loss of the jobs would occur in 1986. And one of the great warning signs, I thought then and certainly clearly in hindsight, was that during that whole 84, 85, 86 time frame, GM never said a word about what they would replace that workload in Janesville. And by the way, sending that product and that workload to Fort Wayne at the end of 86 cost about 1,800 jobs, or at that time nearly half the workforce, and closed half the plant. So their silence for those years, I think, was deafening. I guess that they weren't worried about how worried we were.
How did the workers respond in the 80s? Did they follow the jobs, or did they stay in Janesville?
Well, almost 1,200 of them followed the jobs and went to Fort Wayne. The rest were laid off or took early retirement or whatever they were eligible for. So it was a big deal, and we didn't know. I think the bigger response was, how did the UAW and local management respond? And that's really one of the really great success stories. We were very fortunate at the time to have what they call the shop chairman, Jim Lee. And the shop chairman is the person that everybody knows that the union has a president, but the shop chairman is the one who negotiates contract changes with management. And we were fortunate. We had Jim Lee, because he saw that there was a silence about Janesville. He saw other plants closing around the GM plants closing around the country in 86. There were about three of them. And he realized that we had to do something dramatic to get Detroit's attention, that the Janesville was a place where they should stay and they should want to give us a new product. And so he negotiated a series of changes with management, all of which had to then be approved by the UAW membership in a vote. And he got a lot done. I mean, that was when we went to the 4-day, 10-hour work week, which saved GM a lot of money because they didn't have to fire up the paint plant, the paint shop, one day a week or 20% of the time. It was a very big deal. And they negotiated probably 15 other changes, some of which benefited the workers and some of which benefited GM. But it really showed that GM and management, or UAW and management, could work together. And that was another important signal to Detroit.
Talking with Tim Cullen, he's a former state senator and author of the new book, Disassembled, A Native Son on Janesville and General Motors. You can join in. What stories about the GM factory in Janesville can you share? Did you or perhaps a family member work at the plant? What happened when it closed? Were you able to find other work in the area? Did your family ultimately need to move? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Tim, we've heard of this term, the Janesville Gypsies, from time to time, workers following jobs or they're living in one place and then commuting to work for the work week, coming back on the weekends. Is that still happening to some people in Janesville?
Yes, it is. And they're driving to, they're commuting to Fort Wayne, Indiana, to that new plant down there. Some of them are commuting still to Kansas City. There, I think, there's a 4-hour or 10-hour, 4-day week, so they do get a 3-day weekend. It's quite a thing, and there's usually more than one of them that commute together, but it's still going on. At the time we closed in 08, the workers took jobs in Ohio. They took jobs even in Arlington, Texas. Some commuted, some moved. And the key to that is you need to work 30 years at General Motors to get your pension. So all these workers had a different number of years left when the plant closed in 08. Did they have 3 left to go or 13 left to go? And that usually is a number that determines why several of them are still commuting.
Take us to the footprint today, the GM factory site. How much the plant has been actually taken apart? What does it look like?
It looks like there used to be something there. Everything has been taken down. It has been completely leveled. There's still a lot of rubble there that they haven't removed, but the plant is completely gone. The last thing was the 100-year-old smokestack that they tore down just a few months ago.
Is there any damage to the environment that remains, or any cleanup that remains after this rubble?
Well, the cleanup on the site, I think, is still an unanswered question. And the bigger question yet even then is if there is some environmental damage on the site, the bigger question is going to be who's going to pay for it. And that's not clear. There was clearly some environmental damage to the Rock River, which it sets Rock River is within it's a couple hundred yards of the plant. And that's being dealt with by the DNR. And their public comments are it's manageable and controllable. And that does not seem to be a big concern, but you never know what tomorrow brings either.
Tim Cullen's new book is called Disassembled. He was the third generation of his family to work at GM. We're looking at the economic and social consequences a little over 11 years after the Janesville GM plant closed. Do you live in Janesville? How do you think the community was affected by the plant closure? Has it recovered economically? We're at 800-642-1234. A line open for your insights. Back in a moment with Tim Cullen here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're taking stock of Janesville more than 10 years after the GM plant went dark. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're looking at what happens when a big manufacturer leaves a community and that trickle-down effect from the loss of a plant, the loss of parts suppliers that grow up around a plant. Did you or a family member work at the Janesville GM plant? What was your job? What is life like for you today? Do you work in manufacturing? Has your plant ever been idled or gone through a consolidation? And then how has robotics changed your work? Join in any point through the hour, 800-642-1234. Tweet us, WPR Mornings. Janesville native Tim Cullen stays with us. He co-chaired a task force back in 2008 to try to save the Janesville GM plant, and his new book is called Disassembled. Tim, you know, factory closings happen around Wisconsin from time to time, certainly not on the scale of the Janesville GM plant. What did we learn going through that process, that loss, about helping families when a manufacturer suddenly shuts down?
Well, we learned that it affects not just the workers who lose their jobs. You know, they're the one, and their families, they're the most directly affected. But there's a trickle-down effect as well. Workers at the plant were making $28 an hour. When those jobs are gone, you then, if you're depending on your age and situation, you are then going to compete for other jobs that may be $18 an hour jobs. And so there gets to be this trickle-down effect, and there's more people than there are $18 an hour jobs, and some of them are pushed to $14 an hour jobs and on down. So it impacts the most directly, obviously, the workers who lose their jobs, but it affects everybody in that pay range, or people with the skills to get that level of job. It hurts everybody, and it hurts the community. If you sold anything, if you had a business that sold anything in Janesville, you were hurt by the closing of this plant.
You looked at the plant through several lenses around this word disassembled and disassemblings. And the final disassembling, of course, was the plant itself. Others were GM attempting to remove racial and gender barriers. Let's first look at gender-based pay. How were women paid differently than men at the plant?
Very simply, the main, where 90% or more of the workers work, was on the assembly line, actually assembling the vehicle. But on that assembly line, only men worked there until 1965. Women, there were probably 90%+ of the workers were men, but there was another area off the side called the cushion line, where they put together cushions, seat cushions. And that's where they had the women work. And there were about 80 who worked there each shift, and they were paid less to work on the cushion line than the men made on the assembly line. And that was where Doris Tome comes in, and I can talk about that if you like. But that was she was the first woman to work on the assembly line and get the full pay that men got. And then in 1968, 3 years after she got on the assembly line, the NICS contract made them all pay equal, so there was no gender bias after 1968.
Doris Tome, who challenged gender pay gaps, as you say, after the 1964 Civil Rights Act, what was her work like at the factory, and how was she treated by her male coworkers?
Well, there's a whole chapter on that, and it was a very difficult time for her, but she was a strong woman. She just died in 2018 at the age of 97. And I knew her, went to her funeral. She walked into the plant manager's office and had the 64 Civil Rights Act in her hand. And she said, this new law of our nation says that you cannot discriminate based on gender and pay. And if you don't put me on the assembly line, I'm going to sue you. And the plant manager folded, and they put her on the assembly line. But they gave her one of the most difficult jobs on the assembly line, working down in the pit, working on the bottom of the car or vehicle. And she was given a silent treatment by her male coworkers for some time. And she had difficulty because there are no women that ever worked in the assembly line. There was no women's restroom anywhere near the assembly line. She had to walk like 200 yards to the restroom, and wasn't getting back on time, and she was getting guff from her foreman about getting back too late and so on. I think the neat thing about that was she said to them, to her foreman, I can see a men's restroom from where I'm standing. And she said, if if I can't get more break time to get to the women's restroom, I'm going to go up there and use that men's restroom.
Yeah. Well,
they panicked. And so the solution was they gave her more time to walk to the women's restroom and get back and not have any difficulty. But that was Doris.
We're talking Tim Cullen, a former state senator and author of Disassembled, A Native Son on Janesville and General Motors. What questions do you have about the GM plant closing in Janesville? Do you think government authorities should have done more to save the factory? Does your community have a large manufacturer that employs many people? How do you see its connection to the community today? Is it stable? Join in with your thoughts, your questions, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Tim, you also introduce us to someone named John Scott, who was the third black person hired by GM. The plant had refused to hire African-American workers from its opening in 1923 until the 1960s. Who is John Scott, and how does he get a job at the factory?
John Scott, African-American, who worked on the Chicago Northwestern Railroad, which ran through Chicago, Janesville, Madison, up to Twin Cities. And he heard about Janesville while working in the dining car. And so he came to Janesville in 1948 with his family, his wife, and three children, almost entirely all-white community in 1948, and over 99%. And he wants to buy a house, and his realtor, who he said he liked, in a long interview he did in 1976, the realtor said to him, well, I can't sell you that house until you go around and talk to the neighbors and make sure it's okay with them. Can you imagine that, trying to do that today? So John was not a in-your-face kind of guy. So he said, okay. And he went around and talked to the neighbors around that house, and turns out that two of the four houses he went to, the man in the house worked on the railroad too. So all of a sudden they were talking to each other as you know, fellow railroad workers, not as a black person and a white person. And all his neighbors said, sure, we'd love to have you. So he was then able to buy the house because his neighbors approved of it.
You right.
Then he started applying at the plant, and he had always had a job somewhere, but he wanted to get a job at the plant. He kept getting turned down. And he had joined the Masons at a Masonic Lodge in Beloit. And the Masons have I don't know a whole lot about the Masons, but they have a code of helping each other and a code of silence. And after applying at the plant from 1948 until 1961 and never getting hired, turns out there were two Masons, obviously white Masons, in management at the plant who knew he was a Mason, and they were the two that helped him get hired. So that's how he finally got hired in 1961. The Civil Rights Act of 1964 changed a lot, as well as UAW President Walter Reuther at the time. By 68, 70, I talked about one person who was hired, a white worker who was hired. And the day he was hired, there were like 18 workers, and he was the only white worker hired in 1968. The other 17 were black. So things finally got better. Doesn't mean that people's attitudes change overnight, because they don't, in their views. But the way General Motors operated, the UAW operated, certainly changed.
Yeah, well, you write that racism in the GM plant reflected racism in the city. How do you see the parallels there?
Well, it's hard for not to be. I mean, the plant is in the middle of the city, and the workers, a lot of them live in the city. So you're going to have the same social situations, as I would put it, I guess, in this. If you have it in the plant, you're going to have it in the city, and vice versa.
The gender pay gaps and the racial barriers are still an issue in many industries today. What did you learn from researching the GM factory that might help people understand the current disparities that we see?
Well, the biggest thing I learned is what I learned about John Scott, which is, you know, his attitude was get to know people and let people get to know him, and not to know him as a black man or African-American man, but know him as a father and somebody who wants to work and do a good job and wants to be a good neighbor. I mean, that I think an awful lot of racial bias is because people really don't have a chance to know on any kind of a personal basis person of a different color, particularly white people not knowing black people. That was really the issue then. There were really, I really couldn't find Hispanic, Asian, Native American citizens in Janesville or in the plant. It was a black-white issue.
Talking about the book Disassembled with Janesville native and former state senator Tim Cullen about what the closure of the GM plant did to the economic and social fabric of Janesville, what do you think should be the relationship between private companies and the government? What do you think of the state offering incentives to prevent Kimberly-Clark from closing a factory near Appleton, or the state offering incentives to Foxconn? Join in 800-642-1234. Coming up, we look at the modern-day efforts to save plants. That's after this news update here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're talking about the complicated relationship between GM and Janesville over 85 years. GM plant built its last SUV on December 23rd, 2008. Plant was completely shut down by April 23rd, 2009. And now, a solid decade removed, we're looking at what this did to the fabric of the community, what life is like today. How do you think the government should approach companies that threaten to close factories with hundreds or thousands of jobs at stake? Should the state offer tax credits or other incentives to stay? Do you live in Janesville? How do you think the community was affected by the plant closure? Has it recovered? Join in at any point through the hour, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Tim Cullen's new book is Disassembled, a Native Son on Janesville and General Motors. And he represented Janesville in the state Senate in the 70s and 80s and again from 2011 to 2015. Tim, in 2008, Governor Jim Doyle appointed you to a task force to save the GM plant. What was that like? What were those first meetings like? What did you do?
Well, the first thing we did was we got everybody in the same team. So we had business and labor and Republicans and Democrats in the community, everybody pulling together to try to get GM to change their mind. They had announced that they were going to close the plant. They announced in June of 2008 that they were going to close the plant by 2010. So we thought we had some time. We thought we had the rest of 2008, maybe some of 2009. And then we went to Detroit, Governor Doyle and Republican Congressman Paul Ryan, Democratic governor, Republican congressman. We went to Detroit with a group, and we made our presentation, and they said, this was in September of 2008, and they said they had not made up their final, they had not made a final decision to close the plant. So we went back and put together a $200 million plus package of incentives to get them to stay, which at that time was actually considered a decent number. The Foxconn number kind of makes that number look small, that's for sure, but Foxconn's a whole other story.
Yeah, we'll get to Foxconn in a moment. But what did this task force teach you about how government is involved in whether a manufacturer stays or goes?
Well, what it taught me, probably taught me a lot of things, but it taught me that the corporation, especially if it's an out-of-state corporation, is going to do what they need to do to be a profitable, successful company. And if that includes closing the plant in my hometown, it gets beyond, you know, details like that. It really comes down to political clout. Do you have somebody representing you who General Motors really has to care about far beyond Janesville, in other words, in Washington, D.C.? We had that back in the 80s, early 90s with Les Aspin, the late congressman, who was chairman of the Armed Services Committee, and GM had lots of defense contracts. So they really cared about the chairman of the Armed Services Committee. We lost him. He died in 1995. And we had nobody with that kind of clout in the Wisconsin congressional delegation, clout that GM cared about. Paul Ryan, people say, well, Paul Ryan became speaker. But Paul Ryan was not the speaker in 2008. He was a junior member in the minority party in the House of Representatives at the time. So, we just didn't have clout, which was really going to be the only way that I think we could ultimately save it, because what we didn't know, as I say in the book, what we didn't know made all the difference. General Motors was going broke, and we didn't know that. I don't think anybody in the Janesville plant knew how bad the shape they were in. And General Motors is going broke. Gas prices are go to $4 a gallon. And these big SUVs that we were making so profitably and successfully stopped selling. And General Motors had way too much capacity. They had way too many plants, and they were closing plants. They closed 28 plants between 07 and 09. Unfortunately, we were one of them.
Matt from Wausau emailed to say that GM made huge gas-guzzling cars long after the market had switched over to more economical, smaller vehicles that GM could have retooled to meet demand in Janesville, but for whatever reason, they didn't. What do you think about that analysis?
I think he's correct. General Motors made a decision back in the 70s and 80s that they would stick with the profitable, bigger vehicles and not directly challenge the Japanese models that were coming over, the Toyota and Hondas. And they paid a long-term price for that. And part of the reason why they did that was because they couldn't make as much money on those smaller, fuel-efficient vehicles as they could on the big ones. So they were fine as long as gas prices stayed under control, and that they weren't. But they didn't deal with a lot of their costs, which I talked about in the book. The other thing I would say is we were pretty sure that they were going to move this SUV product that we were making to Arlington, Texas, which was the other place they were making the same vehicle. But they had a fuel-efficient, smaller vehicle called the Chevy Spark. And we were really, at the end, trying to get them to give us the Chevy Spark as a replacement vehicle and keep the plant open. We eventually lost that effort, too, when we lost it to Michigan. And no surprise, Michigan's represented by a fellow who just passed away, Representative John Dingell, who was the Michigan's version of R. Les Aspin back in the 80s. He chaired the committee in Congress, which controlled fuel-efficient standards and miles-per-gallon standards for vehicles. General Motors cared very much about John Dingell. And lo and behold, we did not get the Chevy Spark either. That went to Michigan.
Near the end of your book, Tim, you reflect on whether the government could have done anything to save the plant from closing. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, you have to start with what does GM care about? And they cared about Congress, and they cared about all the standards, vehicle standards that could come out of laws that could help them or hurt them. So they cared about the Congress, and they needed $25 billion. And state governments don't have an extra $25 billion in order to state governments decide the national fuel efficient standards. So the key to saving the thing is you have to have power in Washington.
Talking with Tim Cullen, a former state senator, author of the new book Disassembled, A Native Son on Janesville and General Motors. There's a line for you. What do you remember about the GM plant in Janesville? What stories about the factory can you share? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Tim, in December last year, Governor Scott Walker's administration brokered this $28 million deal to prevent Kimberly-Clark from closing its factory in Neenah. And Kimberly-Clark said the deal kept about 2,400 jobs in the state. How do you feel about that deal, given your own experiences trying to save the Janesville plant?
Well, I'm happy it happened. Saved a whole lot of jobs. It all depends on what the company really wants to do. I don't know. I don't know how serious they were about leaving, but they certainly got the state government's attention. That's the problem with subsidies. You never know whether they really need them or whether they're able to get them. Political leaders have a big obligation to try to save jobs in their state, not only for the workers, but for their own career. It is not helpful to public officials in power to have companies moving out of their state.
You argue that we should be concerned about plants run by these out-of-state corporations or corporations with just one factory in Wisconsin. What are your concerns there?
Well, if we are the only, for example, the large employer that we're talking about, in this case, GM, if they're owned by an out-of-state corporation, then you especially have to worry if you are the only assembly plant in this case that GM has in Wisconsin. And that was the case in 2008. It was the only assembly plant GM had. So GM, if they closed the plant, they didn't have to worry about Wisconsin politicians not being happy with them because they'd be gone. And that was a situation we found ourselves in. But there's a lot of debate going on now about whether financial incentives really affect what a company does or not. But what you're always going to see is the elected officials always trying to offer them. But there's
regardless of market forces,
right? And the, if you think about a large corporation like General Motors, they would say, and that's probably accurate, they can't afford to worry about a particular plant, a particular community. They have, you know, they've got this, you know, multi-billion-dollar corporation in several communities across the country, and especially when they're going broke and their own CEO's job is on the line, like it was in 2008, they can hardly afford to worry about a community, one community, Janesville.
Well,
and they didn't.
Let's take a moment to talk about Foxconn. If Wisconsin could put together a $4 billion deal to attract Foxconn, why couldn't it build a package of similar size to keep General Motors?
Well, we're talking about, really, even though it's only 10 years or so, it's a different era. I don't think Wisconsin had $4 billion to be trying to get General Motors to stay. And where was it? You know, the taxpayers would probably be in revolt 11 years ago. And I think the Foxconn deal is going to, I can't help but think that it's going to end up the same way that a lot of what happened in Janesville, which is robots. Robots were a major reason why the GM plant in Janesville went from 7,100 workers in the early 1970s to about 3,500 at the time they closed. It was other efficiencies, but largely robots. And why Foxconn? Because really, any assembly line job, which is created by its nature to be repetitive, can potentially be replaced by a robot. And that's robots don't they don't call in sick, and they don't have pensions, they don't have to pay, and they're I'll be surprised if my own prediction is that there's going to be an awful lot of robots at Foxconn.
We're talking with former State Senator Tim Cullen about his new book called Disassembled. It looks at the closure of the Janesville GM plant, what happened now a decade removed, and what is life today, and how cities all over fare after the loss of a big manufacturer. Your thoughts, your questions, 800-642-1234. Back in a moment with Tim Cullen here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer. Ken, thanks for being here for this hour-long conversation on life in Janesville following the closure of the GM plant a decade ago. It's a story about Janesville. It's about GM. But we're also learning about racial and gender biases. Women and African Americans broke barriers at the plant during its 85-year history in Janesville. Did you or a family member work at the plant? What happened when it closed? Were you able to find other work in the area? Did you need to move away? What do you think of the state offering incentives to prevent manufacturers from closing down? Still time for you. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. And former state senator and Janesville native Tim Cullen stays with us. His new book is Disassembled. Tim, you ask this interesting question in your book. You ask, would we support the GM plant being built in the first place back in the 20s, knowing it wouldn't last, that it would leave the community 85 years later? Being that you were a third-generation worker at the plant, where do you fall on that question?
Well, it's a question that theoretically is posed to an adult in 1923 when GM started making vehicles in Janesville. And I think I would probably say if I was in 1923, I'd probably say I'll take the 85 years. It led to a huge middle-class population in Janesville with with thousands of children of auto workers going to college, the first person in their family to go to college. It made a really successful economy in Janesville for a long, long time. So I think I would have in 1923 said, I'll take the deal.
How do you think your life in Janesville would have been different without the factory?
Well, mine would have been a lot. My dad worked there, and you mentioned I was third generation. Well, the reason why I was able to work there, I was going to go to college at Whitewater, and GM had a program where the sons of workers there, if they had a son going to college, they would potentially get hired in the plant for a summer job.
Not open to daughters?
Not open to daughters. I was going to get to that. Yep. It paid $3.25 an hour, which sounds today like, you know, peanuts, but Cokes were 10 cents and hamburgers from McDonald's were 15 cents then. And tuition at Whitewater for a semester was $110, about $3,500 today.
That's perspective.
And the $3.25 an hour, most other, it was the best summer job in Rock County. Most other summer jobs that kids got were $1, $1.25 an hour. So that for me in my life, it made all the difference. I paid my entire way through Whitewater with that job at the plant. I worked there 4 summers in various parts of the plant. So it also gave me a perspective on what it was actually like to work in there when I was writing this book.
What was it like for, you know, a young man to work at this plant, a plant that, you know, there were so many people, you could probably look around the assembly line and see neighbors?
Well, that was true, and my dad worked there, and my dad was a, this may sound, you know, self-serving or whatever, but my dad was a pretty well-liked guy down there, and I was Bill Cullen's son, so I think that always kind of helped me a little bit, but it could be a rough place to work. The language and everything else was pretty rough, and I think, you know, you mentioned about they didn't offer the daughters of workers. I'm not so sure, and I never thought about it at the time, but I think about it now. I'm not so sure a lot of those fathers wanted their 18-year-old daughters working in that plant, just because it was a tough place to work, and the conversations and the behavior, some people, vast majority were good people, but they're always, you put a few thousand people together, you're going to have some jerks.
You talked with some former managers, people tied to the plant, who wouldn't use their name in your book. Why wouldn't they come forth? Why would they tell their story and they did not want to have their name withheld?
Well, I believe that they wanted to tell the truth. And the truth is not always pretty. I was asked them to confirm certain things. And I think they're now retired and they're living and probably socializing and knowing lots of other people in management. So I just don't think they wanted to be, named. But what I found was, by them being anonymous, was they could be completely honest with me. And they were enormously helpful to me, particularly one of them, letting me know I would learn something that happened and thought it would happen. Some UAW guys said it happened this way, and I could ask them, how did this happen? Some of the issues back in the 1990s. And they were very helpful. It actually gave me a new understanding of what we see these stories where anonymous sources in Washington have told the Washington Post or the New York Times something. And one of the things about anonymous sources, first, you're not using their name, but secondly, they can tell you the truth.
We're talking with Tim Cullen. He's a former state senator, and his new book is called Disassembled, A Native Son on Janesville and General Motors. Still time for your thoughts, your questions on the economic and social implications when a big manufacturer is at the center of a community and it goes away. We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Tim, what do you see as for the future for Janesville's economy? As you look ahead, you don't see a footprint anymore, only rubble from where the GM plant was. What does the economy look like in Janesville going forward?
Well, it's probably not going to be large manufacturers with assembly line work. I just don't think that's going to happen. Robots are going to do that, even if one came to Janesville. We've started to look like we're a location for distribution centers, like Dollar General is one that's here now. Those kind of jobs are are jobs, and they pay more in the $14-$18 range jobs. But we'll see. There's a developer who bought the site and has proposed a plan of what he would like to see developed there. He's not going to be operating there. He's just developing the site. And we'll see if companies want to come there, either through manufacturing or be a distribution center. Janesville has, location-wise, has some great things going for it. It sits right on I-90. It has two different railroad lines that service that plant site. We have an airport nearby. We've got a utility service. We have utility, line energy.
So transportation hub is a huge, huge plus for a community. What would you tell communities that have a large manufacturer to help make sure that it is stable, that it is not fragile, that relations are going well, and that manufacturer is doing as well as possible for that community?
Well, first of all, I have to acknowledge which is that they're in charge. The corporation is going to decide whether they stay or go. And absent some powerful figure in Washington, they can make them do what they don't want to do. That's one of the big things I think you just have to acknowledge. So acknowledge that, and then work with them every way you can. And don't give them any reasons to leave. That's how I would probably summarize it.
If General Motors or another automaker wanted to come back to the community, do you think it would be welcome?
I think it would be welcome. I don't think there's any question it would be welcome. We also are going to have a legacy center in Janesville. It's not like a museum, really, but it's yet to be developed. But it's going to be downtown Janesville. It's going to be a place that all the memorabilia and everything else from the plants are going to be there. It's going to be a place for people who are going to want to visit in Janesville as well as lots of other places. And so the legacy of this plant is going to live on for a long time. And so I think given that attitude, I think somebody else wanting to come, like you said, I think would be very welcome.
Since your book, have you heard new stories from GM workers? Has it triggered other memories for families?
Well, that's the thing. Everybody who worked there, or their kids or their whatever, they all have stories. That's what this Legacy Center, I think, is going to really contribute is a lot of those stories. They actually had a whole project where they took the bricks from the plant as it was torn down and cleaned them up and gave them away to people. And they had a big brick giveaway. I got in line and got Mike to get two bricks. And we had over 1,500 cars came to the site to get their two bricks as a memory of the plant.
Where are your bricks?
My bricks are, I can see them right now where I'm sitting. My bricks are in my home. I gave one to my stepdaughter, who actually typed my book. So I gave one to her, but I kept one.
Tim, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Tim Cullen is a former state senator, author of the book Disassembled, A Native Son on Janesville and General Motors. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.